for Sincerely Jennifer with me, Jennifer Wan. Spending time together in these crazy times when you're not supposed to spend time with anyone, but we're still doing it inside the rules, so it's okay. No one can arrest us or give us a fine or whatever, or put us in like corona jail. I don't know if that's a thing, but I wouldn't be surprised if it ended up being one. Anyway, how are we settling in with the new theme? I'm having a good time with it. I feel like maybe it makes these little initial preambles a bit redundant, but I kind of like doing them anyway, so I'm gonna keep doing that. You'll be pleased to know that there is a slight air of non-bleakness on this week's episode. Not too much, don't get excited, but you know, I had some vague feelings that may have been happiness, I don't know. So that was good news. Hooray for that. It has been so many days. 366 to be exact, since I sent my dreams down the river on a boat I planned to sink. Seeing love as a damaging dream that would kill me if I didn't kill it myself. I spent a summer writing to myself, sitting on the shelf where I felt safest, banishing roses from my bedroom, blood red beating heart begging for company. I lamented, languishing in loss, living in a grey world, dreaming of the dream I drowned. I wrote a world of roses and promises, but, well, sometimes books burn. They are torn and tattered when they are given with love but not loved in return, so I decided to stop just writing to myself, spending San Jordi with my soul, buying myself books, roses, and cider. This year, I am at the riverbed, reviving the dream that I drowned and mourned, writing new books with new twists and turns, roses on my skin with each kiss you plant, and I give those kisses, sweet like roses, to the dream that found her way back to me. My heart safe in your gentle hands, my dream alive, my soul. Are you feeling loved and romanced and seduced and things? Must be because it's San Jordi. Well, I mean, it is for me right now as I record this, but because I'm recording this on a Thursday. By the time you listen to it, it would have happened. But you know what? Every day is an occasion to be romantic and nice to people. So just do it anyways. Anyway, for those that don't know what it is, it's a Catalan tradition, I guess you could call it. You celebrate the people you love. So traditionally, a man would buy roses for the person that he loves. A woman would buy a book for the person that she loves. I think it's very lovely. It's like Valentine's Day, but cultural and shit. I love that. And it's, when I was growing up, it was always something I wanted to actually participate in, but I never got to that point where I could. And then when I was an adult and I had experience with love and relationships, it never went well for me. But now, right, just as I get in a position where I have somebody that I want to actually do all these things for, there's a fucking pandemic and I legally cannot go and do nice things for him because, well, damn it, we'd be fined. And so, but I did use the miracles of technology. I compiled a little book of nice things I had written about him to send to him, so that I could still feel like I was doing what I wanted to do, just in a very online way, you know. And you kind of compare it to, because obviously it's St. George's Day, it's how it's celebrated in England where I live. And you know what? I was going to try and not be petty. And I was going to be like, you know what? They celebrate it their way and that's fine. I do it this way, you know, and that's fine. And I was just going to live and let live. But then I woke up today and trending on Twitter was proud to be English. Now, that's fine, I guess, if that's what you want to do. But the whole tag was filled with, like, whiny far-right people. And I was like, what are they? Like, fine, whatever. If that is how you choose to spend this day, fine, I guess. But personally, I feel like a day where you appreciate and celebrate the people in your life that mean something to you. I just feel like that's a better way to do it. I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, if I look at the influences in my life and the parts of myself that I can draw from, you know, and I have two options for how I spend this day, I feel like celebrating the people that mean a lot to me is a better use of my time than obsessing over which country I live in and making that the center of my identity. You know, I'm just saying, but I guess, you know, that is one of the benefits of multiculturalism, but just in a very personal sense for me, because it means I have options. I, you know, I don't have to join in with all the, you know, we want our country back, lads, nonsense, which is funny because a lot of the people now posting shit like that and, you know, making up nonsense about how you get arrested for saying that you're English or having an English flag outside your house are the same people who tonight at 8 p.m, again, I'm recording this segment on a Thursday, at 8 p.m. tonight, they will be standing outside their house, banging pots and pans, clapping for the National Health Service, knowing full well that the National Health Service only functions as it does, as well as it does, because of people all over the world who, quite frankly, honour this country by choosing to make it their home. And yet, you know, there are some people that are going to spend this day, the 23rd of April, whinging about how hard it is to be a white English person and how, you know, immigrants are ruining everything and why won't they let us celebrate St. George, who also wasn't from here, but they seem to ignore that and pretend he's from Essex or something. You know, it's just... Anyway, I gave my boyfriend a nice book and we're going to celebrate being in love. So that's what I'm doing with my 23rd of April. I'm glad I'm in a place where I can do that. Because for a long time I wasn't, and it fucking sucked. Because, you know, there's this option of a nice way of spending the day that doesn't exclude people and hasn't been kind of kidnapped and bastardized by the far right. Because I'm sure that back in the day there probably were nice English ways of spending St. George's Day. I have personally never seen any, but I'm sure that there are. But now it's just kind of been taken over by people complaining about everything. It's just a bit, you know, hashtag National Front, which is a bit concerning when you are quite foreign looking, I'm not going to lie. But, you know, we could just steal it back and we could be like, let's talk about nice things in England. Let's be, you know, spend the day being nice to other people in England that we like, you know, including the people who have chosen England to be their home, because that is a big thing, you know, not to be a, you know, follow back pro-European lefty lovey about it, although I am all of those things, but somebody choosing your country and saying, I want to be part of you, that to me is a beautiful thing. But I mean, you know, a lot of people here don't think so, so I feel like my little concept for a reinvented St. George's Day isn't going to catch on, so I guess I'll just be doing St. George by myself at home, especially because we've all got to stay at home. But, you know, I'll just do my thing, they can do their thing, I guess. And they'll be a bit different, but that's okay, because difference is good, right? I grow white orchids under the sunlight that goes back and forth, arriving, leaving, surrounded by poppies in the garden, waiting for the day that they will surround me as I approach you, glowing, going towards heaven on earth. You are watching me. Morning coffee keeps your hands warm until I return to them, safe and smiling, surrounded by beautiful birdsong, watching our flowers thrive. As you'll know, since this whole thing began, I've been taking more and more walks to the park, because while I do have a garden, technically, it is a very small garden. So small that I haven't really been able to plant anything in it because it is very, very tiny. And so I tend to go to the park just to see a bit of nature and and feel a bit less closed in. But one of the things that I feel has probably been sustaining me during this crazed period of time is thinking about what I'm going to do after I'm going to have this garden, right? Obviously, the constraints of my current garden are a problem. So I'm thinking a bit in the future, you know, when I'm living somewhere with a bigger garden. And I've been planning out, like, all the things I'm going to plant. Like, I have this document on my phone with, like, all the things that I want, all the flowers and everything. I was thinking of an apple tree, too. I was just thinking about that. But then I was like, wait, girl, it's going to take forever for actual apples to show up, like... Do you really have the attention span for this? But we'll see. And so I was just thinking about it the other day, and then I sort of started writing about just my adventures in gardening, I suppose. And, you know, just this sort of ideal picture of what could happen after whatever the hell it is we're all going through now is done. You know, and it's like I was saying last week about summer. You know, you hang on to summer because it gives you something to aim for, and you think, well, if I behave myself and I do what I have to do and we all get through it together, you know, a proper, I hate the term, but you know what I mean, like a war effort. You know, that's a thing I've seen a lot, and it happens in you know, the national effort, you know, sing for the Queen, clap for the NHS, stay inside for your neighbours, go to the shop for your biscuits, you know. But you do all that and then you get summer at the end of it and it's lovely. Summer may not realistically happen in the way we think it is. So I have kind of like sidestepped and I'm like, okay, so maybe summer doesn't happen. So I need something else. And for me, that is a little garden, some poppies, some orchids, maybe like some strawberries, some apples, if we can make that happen, I don't know, roses. It will be nice. And I'll just be spending my time in there with the cats too as well, Violet and Lilac, as you may have heard if you are a regular listener. I'm going to have these two cats, Violet and Lilac. They're going to be cool as fuck. They'll hang out with me in the garden. And we'll just sit planting things and writing things. And, you know, I just feel like that is going to happen for me. I'm not going to lie. And thinking about that helps, you know. And I think about things like, sometimes it's really mundane things, you know. Like, maybe not this Christmas because we don't know what's going to happen, but like maybe next Christmas, you know, I'm going to go and I'm going to finally go to one of them department stores and buy like fancy Christmas stuff, you know. When I this last year, I was making a music video for my annual Christmas song. And do you know what? I have an update on that too, because this year I decided maybe I'm going to try writing a happy Christmas song, and I started it like last week. And as a work in progress, I'm going to try a couple more things and see what I can come up with. But anyway, so I'm writing Christmas songs in April. That's where we are now. But I was filming the video, and some of the shots in the video are basically close-ups of Christmas decorations that I saw in John Lewis, which is like a fancy department store, and everything is expensive and for rich people. And, you know, I honestly, I felt a bit like I shouldn't have even been in there, but I was just like milling around the little Christmas display filming things. No one seemed to mind, which was nice of them. but anyway, and so some of the shots in there are just like hugely close-up shots of like the decorations and the displays they had, because I wanted to kind of create this kind of like nostalgic but out of reach image, if that makes sense. Anyways, I'm getting away from my point. The point is I could go back to John Lewis, for example, or to like Debenhams, or like, my God, If I Dare to Dream, Fortnum and Mason. And that's not gonna happen, but I could go to one of these fancy as fuck stores. And this year, or next year, or whenever this Christmas occurs, I could not just be filming extreme close-ups of the decorations so that I could scan them into my music videos. No, I mean, I would do that as well, because, you know, waste not, want not. And I would probably use the footage for something. But I could buy them for my house, for my tree. And, you know, thinking about things like that, you know, what's going to happen after? Because it can't be like this forever. And it can't be terrible after forever either. So thinking of little things and keeping them in my mind and creating things from them and mapping out these concepts and these days that I want to happen and I will make happen is so fulfilling. What the actual fuck is going on with this whole politics business?
Well, everyone really needs to stand up and say that, okay, no, this is not politics in the normal British way. This is something darker and bleaker, and it's got to stop.
Peace is possible and must be achieved.
We want Scotland to remain in
inside the EU, and we want the UK to remain inside the EU.
Labour is weak and divided, and completely unable to offer any sort of opposition to the Tories.
And I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energise the country, we're going to get Brexit done.
But the party that I lead is an independent political party.
Okay, so I want to get started with the really super important life-changing stuff that is going on straight off the bat, and then get to the boring stuff later. So, politics brought us the memes. Now, you may not think that's important, but if that is how you feel, then honestly, I feel like you listened to the wrong show. So, parliaments are going digital where possible. So, Zoom meetings, you know, people on Skype and shit, they started setting up in Westminster. So there are some people that go to the chamber, but a lot of people are doing like video calls to do things like asking questions and scrutinizing the government and so on and so forth. Now, in Wales, my god, so basically what happened, they're having a Zoom session. And a Welsh health minister was caught talking about one of his party colleagues in the Labour Party, swearing about her. And he left his mic on, so everybody heard it. There are screenshots going around social media. I think there's videos as well. You should try and look it up if you can, because it is hilarious. The reactions, everyone was shocked, appalled, laughing naturally. It was just peak. It was everything. It was one of those things you had to laugh or you were just gonna like throw yourself out of a window. It was so funny for all the wrong reasons. But you can watch the video again and again and just focus on a different person's reaction every time, and it's so funny. And I can't wait for more drama like this. I really, really can't. Because this is truly everything that I wanted from this whole digital parliament experience. I am living for it. In Westminster, all the MPs, when they're appearing on camera, they're all trying to look super smart. You know, they've all got big bookshelves in the background to try and make themselves look proper intellectual and shit, which is adorable. And it's, you know, some of them have put paintings in the background, and it's, you can tell that they have, curated these backgrounds to try and look cool or intelligent or whatever, you know, that kind of vibe that they're going for is. And it's just, I mean, there have been MPs that because of their Wi-Fi, they've been unable to connect when they were due to ask a question or to speak, which is, maybe they'll take, you know, broadband capability a bit more seriously now that they are experiencing it for themselves. It was, oh, Jesus. Just the whole thing. Virtual parliament. I am living for it, but at the same time, I am dying. And so is a lot of their Wi-Fi connections, which is cute. Jim Shannon as well. This isn't an important thing, but it made me laugh at the time. And also I started thinking about other things. So Jim Shannon, if you don't know, is from the Democratic Unionist Party in Northern Ireland. And he is, well, you know, he's that kind of guy. He went to Parliament in person, right? From Northern Ireland to London in person to seek approval, or more, not so much approval, but like clarification on the changes to abortion laws in Northern Ireland. Obviously, last year, there was a lot of work going on to try and bring Northern Ireland into line with the rest of the UK in terms of abortion rights, equal marriage rights. And the Democratic Unionist Party are not happy about that because, well, they're awful. And so Jim Shannon turned up and then he was speaking in a debate where they were talking about, you know, the changes to Parliament to make it digital and virtual and so on and so forth. And they were discussing that motion. And he said that he had only learned how to text 2 years ago. So he had only learned how to send a text message in 2018. And, well, firstly, I laughed because that's just a funny image to me. But secondly, I thought about the fact that a lot of people, when they're elected to Parliament, especially at Westminster, it tends to be older people, you know, sort of ranging from middle-aged all the way up. And yes, they have, you know, teams of staff that can help them with digital stuff. But surely it would be worthwhile to look at a course in digital literacy for members of Parliament. So covering things like emailing, social media use for sure, so we don't have more examples of them being embarrassing on Twitter, video calling. It could open up possibilities like, you know, digital surgeries for their constituents. You know, when I used to live in the Sevenoaks constituency, our MP only held surgeries in two of the towns in the constituency. Now, I lived in a very rural part of the constituency, so it was difficult for me to get to either one. And that was me as a, you know, relatively okay, able-bodied person. Somebody who's very vulnerable and can't travel long distances wouldn't have been able to go at all. Now, if he had been able to offer a digital option, something like a Zoom chat or, you know, a Google Hangout, that kind of thing, or a web chat, something like that, to be able to help people with their issues without them having to leave the house and trek halfway across the constituency, that would have made a huge difference. But he didn't do that because, well, I don't know, I guess he was too busy getting drunk and sexually harassing journalists. So, allegedly. Although he did admit to doing it, so I don't know if I still have to say allegedly anymore, but, you know, I mean, he's rich as fuck, so he could sue me into the ground, so I'm going to say it anyway. But, you know, things like that could be very helpful for members of Parliament to be able to offer more services to their constituents to help them. So I don't really think that an MP openly saying, oh, I don't know anything about technology, I only just learned how to text, I don't answer emails, I don't feel like that should be a badge of pride. I mean, Dennis Skinner used to talk about how he didn't bother with emails, you know, and he, you know, it's like, well, a lot of your constituents will, and that could be how they're trying to reach out to you. It shouldn't be the case that you don't know how to do these things. So if we teach them how to do these things, then there are no excuses and there are more ways for people to get in touch with them if they need help. I feel like now is the right time to do that. If we're looking at making things more digital anyway, why not also throw that in? It helps people. It also gives them skills for if they lose their seat and then they have to get a regular job. You know, then they've got skills that they can use in the workplace. And then we don't have to fucking pay them when they lose their seat. Because, well, that happens, which is absurd. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but most people who get fired from their job don't get thousands of pounds because they lost their job. That's not a thing that normally happens. So if we give MPs transferable skills, then maybe we'd have to do that anymore. That'd be fun. Protective equipment is still something that is very much at the front of people's minds in regards to coronavirus and what the hell is happening with that. And the government and MPs from the governing party seem to be very defensive when anyone asks, including what I thought to be a very cringe tweet. A Tory MP, my God, she was a nurse before she was an MP. I'm assuming she's still on the nursing register, and that's nice. She tweeted, "Just finished latest shift at hospital. Nose and ears sore from wearing masks for last 48 hours, but not complaining, as despite media reports, we have plenty of PPE. Love getting back working in NHS." And then she, for some reason, tweeted the health secretary, I'm assuming in the hopes that he would retweet it. As Maria Caulfield, I think, she's not really an important MP, so I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Anyway, that's not the point. The point is, she put up this little backhanded tweet of, "I'm back working as a nurse because I'm qualified to do so," which is great, and we support that, we love that. But then she finishes with a little backhanded thing of, "Despite media reports, we have plenty of protective equipment." Well, sweetie, why would other doctors and nurses who've talked about it lie? Because where do you think those media reports come from, right? They're not, the newspapers, the journalists, they're not just making it up for fun. They are reporting on things that they are being told by people who work in NHS hospitals, right? So that's doctors, nurses, healthcare assistants, porters, cleaners, catering staff are coming to these journalists and telling them about their experiences. Now, the hospital that you work in might have enough equipment to go round, and that's nice for you. But there are a lot of hospitals across the UK, a lot of hospitals just in England, and a lot of staff in those hospitals are reporting something different to what you have experienced. So just because you had a nice time and you got all the equipment you wanted, that doesn't mean that everyone else who has talked about this and given a different perspective is lying. And to be honest, I feel like it's disingenuous for her to use her platform to try and make it look like all these other people are lying. It's like, I get it, you have to stick with your party's line and you have to, you know, make your government look good, but you're doing that at the expense of your colleagues in the NHS. You are turning your back on them. You are calling them liars. You are painting them as liars to make your government look good. I just... And for what? You know, what would these other doctors and nurses and NHS staff have to gain from lying about not having protective equipment? You know, it's not like they would get anything from it. It's not like they get, you know, money or fame or anything, you know, because most of them coming forward are doing so anonymously because they're afraid of what's going to happen to them if they speak up about it. So they gain nothing from talking to journalists about this. So why would they do so if they weren't telling the truth? And of course, journalists are not just going to report something without seeing any proof. So you're telling me that all these other medical staff and the journalists associated with the publication of these stories, they're all lying and you are the only person telling the truth, Maria? Because I don't buy that for a second, and I don't think anyone else does. And to me, it seems like abuse of her platform as a member of parliament to be spreading this shit around and acting like everybody's lying about the lack of protective equipment. You know, I mean, there was also a story over the weekend. We were supposed to, in the UK, receive a shipment of protective equipment, I believe, from Turkey. Turkey was sending us some protective equipment. It was then delayed because it turned out the order hadn't been placed yet. And so it took longer to get here. Now, if we're supposed to believe that all the hospitals have enough protective equipment and they're all fine, firstly, why are we ordering stuff from Turkey in the first place? You know, because surely we would say to them, well, you keep it, we've got enough. If we're to believe that our NHS has the full stock of what it needs, it has more than what it needs, it's all good because Maria said so, why are we ordering from other countries anyway? Why are we not saying to them, no, you keep that, you look after yourselves, you know, stay safe, stay home, protect whatever your version of the NHS is, we're fine, we've got enough. Why are we taking protective equipment from other countries, if we have enough? That would be my question. She's sitting there and she's trying to act like there's no shortage at all. But if that's the case, why are we having to procure it from overseas? Why are lots more medical staff saying that there is a shortage? Are we supposed to believe everybody else is lying and it's just Maria from the Conservative Party who happens to be telling the truth? Because, well, no, I don't believe you. I don't. I'm sorry. I mean, it's nice that you went in and you did a shift. That's lovely. We appreciate that. But there's no need to lie to try and make your government look good. It's just a bit cringy at this point. But again, what do we expect? So the Times, which is a newspaper here in the UK, I am aware that I do have quite a lot of listeners outside of the UK, so I do want to keep things, you know, sort of, I don't want to say easy to understand, because I think that's a bit patronising, but I don't want to, you know, just say things and assume that you'll get what I mean, because that just seems really exclusionary. Anyway, so the Times newspaper. I don't personally read the Times. It's not my kind of thing. I like all, you know, soft left, you know, pacifists. Read the Guardian. So, but yes, the Times. They gave us some drama at the end of last weekend. Two types of drama, in fact. Boris drama and ethics and journalism drama. Now, there is a phrase that you probably thought, my God, I hope I never hear that again after the Gamergate kerfuffle, but here we are. So, they published an article about Boris Johnson and the response to coronavirus in the UK and how Boris Johnson's actions may have led to more deaths than, you know, than a different outcome that we could have reached had he done something differently. However, they put that article behind a paywall. So there was a lot of people who were angry, not just at what they read in the article, but also about the fact that the article itself had been put behind a paywall. Now, obviously, journalism has to earn money as an industry so that it can continue. And I get that 100%. A lot of people were suggesting things like a Spotify kind of model for journalists, like, so you could, like, you would have like an app, I guess, and you can read, or, you know, you pay a monthly fee and then you read, you know, the articles that you want to read, and then, you know, it gets divided up between which was read and which wasn't. And a lot of people seem to think that was a really brilliant, amazing, innovative idea. And let me just say, as somebody who, you know, has content on Spotify and has to deal with their payment system and what they think is fair to pay us, no. Anyway, all that drama aside, the point was Boris Johnson had skipped COBRA meetings on the virus. Enough hadn't been done to order protective gear. And it was just a fucking mess. I feel like from what's unfolding around us, we could all see that anyway. It was quite obvious the response has not been as it should have been. But I feel like some people are just trying to get on with it and just saying, okay, yes, it's fucked up, but we are where we are and we need to try and get through this. And I get that as a concept. But I feel like after this is over, there will have to be an independent inquiry. The government has already been asked about this. Ed Davey, who is the interim leader of the Liberal Democrats, did ask Dominic Raab, who is standing in for Boris Johnson at Prime Minister's questions, about this. And Dominic Raab gave some nonsense answer about, oh, I don't know about an inquiry, but we're going to learn some lessons. But I think an inquiry is going to happen, and it should. But we'll see. Can a dog born in a stable call itself a horse? I call myself the name that my English mother gave me, and I arrive to an audience of doctors and nurses. The NHS is in a state, but they're not dragging babies out in stables yet. So, am I a dog or a horse or a swallow singing arias on the way out of a sea of scrubs and sedatives? It always turns out that an English mother, a name my teachers could pronounce, fluency in what is, if we're being honest, an ugly language, and several years of taxes don't actually count, because it doesn't matter what you put in, how you change, or what you take out, some people are marked, faded ink on a passport, but still visible to armchair border force guards. You know, I never thought of myself as a dog. Or a horse. I haven't actually got enough legs to be either, and I tried not to be so bothered, finding home far away where the other half of my heart and DNA lies, but it was a lie. It was a fiction that I felt in every inch of my unclaimed, unwanted soul, abandoned by a parent who feels no sense of duty and no sense of shame, who tells me to assimilate and then tells me to fuck off back to the stable of shame, pinning a tail on the donkey and then pulling it off over and over until I just sort of break down and whisper, in perfect English, I might add, fine, I'm a dog, I'm a horse, I'm not here, but I am, but I'll go. And then the stable is full of people, blinking, blinded in confusion, talking quietly among themselves, and not one of them is the same. Because nobody actually is. No matter how much you close your eyes to blur the lines that form your entire identity, we are all people crammed into a stable on an island on a planet that is dying. So does it really matter if I call myself a dog or a horse or perhaps by the name my English mother gave me? So I've been thinking more about St. George's Day in specifics. I think the reason I don't like St. George's Day in the English sense of it is because it kind of has always felt like a day devoted to telling me that people like me are not supposed to be here. And I'm like, what the fuck do you want me to do about it? I was born here. I have lived here for quite a lot of my life at this point. I've contributed. What do you want me to do? You know, and that there is, of course, every year on St. George's Day, there is this discussion, this debate as to whether somebody who is not white can be English. And it happens every year, and it's never in good faith. And I don't know why we entertain it every year, but we do. And I just, it's fucking exhausting. It's like, what do we have to do to prove that we're supposed to be here? You know, and at some point you start thinking, well, maybe I don't want to fucking be here. You know, maybe I'm just a person who's trapped here out of circumstance, you know. I could leave, is that what you want? And of course they actually do, but but yeah, so it's, I've talked about this a lot before, but I've always found it very hard to really feel any proper connection to the English part of my heritage and to feel anything about it, because it's just a thing that happens to be there. And a lot of people mistake that and they think it means, you know, I must hate English people or whatever, and that's not true. I don't hate English people. Some of my favorite relatives are English. Yeah, see, that excuse doesn't seem as robust when it's on the other side, does it? You know, Mr. and Mrs., but I have black friends, or I have gay friends. Anyway, but on a serious note, you know, I don't hate English people. I don't even hate England. I mean, the weather's a bit shit, and frankly, there are a lot of things that I would change, but I don't hate it. And, you know, those things are more, you know, in the spectrum of, you know, I would want people to have more rights in terms of employment and, you know, good wages and, you know, things like that. Not huge sweeping changes. But anyway, I'm getting away from the point. The point is, it's hard to latch on to an identity where it very much feels like you are excluded from that and nobody wants you there. And even the people that are, you know, that do want you there, sometimes it's kind of difficult because it's like, well, just these people isn't enough when everybody else is kind of not into that. But I think there is kind of more efforts from, you know, ethnic minority communities in England to kind of redefine what Englishness is. And that's interesting to me as an idea. But to be quite honest with you, I do feel like it's too late for me personally, because when I think about Englishness and I think of that as something for myself, I don't feel anything and I don't see anything. And it's too far gone at this point. There's too much damage that has been done. And I'm just like, nah, mate. Nah, I don't think so. I don't think that you guys deserve me. You know, I'm just saying, I've moved past it, you know. But for other people, I think if that's what they want to do and they want to, you know, reclaim that and reframe it and think about what it means for them, I think that's a good idea. And I think that's, I hope it works out for them. But for me, I'm at the point now where I'm like, okay, we get it. Like, you guys think I'm not actually English or whatever. By you guys, I don't obviously mean you guys listening. Because I'm pretty sure nobody at this point is like hate listening to me because they're offended by my, you know, obsessive ethnic behavior or something like that. I don't think that's the case. I'm talking more to the people that, you know, I guess gatekeep being English. If that makes sense. You know, the kind of people, I could show them my passport, I could show them my birth certificate, I could take them to, well, I don't think I could take them to the hospital I was born in, because I think it's not there anymore, but I could take them to where it was, and I could be like, there we go, that's where it was. Or, you know, I could introduce them to my mum, who is from England, you know, and all my family. But it wouldn't really make a difference to them because they'll never see me the same as them. And so I'm at this point where I'm like, well, okay, fine. If you do not want to accept that, okay, well, I don't accept being part of your thing either. I'm going to go off and do my own thing. Fuck you, bitches. Which was kind of freeing in a way. No longer wanting the approval of people that will never approve of you is a very liberating experience, and I'd recommend it for everybody. But at the same time, I understand people that want to not so much have that approval, but take that label and use it in their own way. And I support those people too. It's just not something I personally see myself doing. There is no real desire in me to be identified again at any point in my life as English. I have an English accent and I live in England, but those are just things that are not currently in my control right now. Those are just things that happen to be a thing. I'm certainly not going to live in England forever. That I know for sure. And, you know, I could do a different accent. How about that? I could do this one. But that's not going to make any sense because I'm still planning to live in Europe. So doing this accent is not going to make any sense.
But I can't do the accent of where I'm going to move to. So so that sucks. But maybe I could learn. I could probably find some YouTube tutorials. I was thinking the other day, I had like, you know, shower thoughts where you suddenly think of something really random in the shower and it makes a lot of sense to you and you have to tell somebody. I had one of those, but I wasn't in the shower. I was just like in the garden. And I just thought, when I'm 30, I'm going to start talking with a transatlantic accent. You know, like they used to do in the old movies and stuff, and how Evan Peters did in American Horror Story Hotel. I'm going to do that. So I have a couple years. I'm going to start learning. I found like lots of tutorials online. So I'm going to get me one of those and I'm going to start talking like that. And then no one would really know where the fuck I'm from anyways. And they're going to be like, wow, what is that accent? And I'll be like, worldly. It's a worldly accent. I can't do it quite yet. It's a work in progress. But, you know, and it'll be very ambiguous and no one will know. And it'll be a mystery. And I feel like that would be a fun development for me. So I'm going to start working on that. That could be my thing I do during quarantine, because we're all supposed to be doing things and I could be like, well, I modified my accent irrevocably to own the far right, you know, in preparation for when I move far out of their reach anyway. Yeah, I totally put one over on them. But I don't know, I feel like it'd be exotic and fancy and vintage. So I'm gonna start doing that and I will let you know my progress and how it goes. Okay, so this is slightly coronavirus related. I just wanted to let everyone know that. So, last week, WWE, which is, I would say, and I think most people would say, the biggest wrestling company in the world, they were announced as an essential service in the US for some reason, because apparently wrestling shows are essential. There was quite a lot of shady stuff going on. Linda McMahon runs some kind of, I'm not as good with American politics as I am British, but I think they're called, like, they're basically like fundraising things for elections and shit, and she runs one and she's giving a bunch of money to support Donald Trump's campaign in Florida. And so the state of Florida has now deemed the company that her husband runs as an essential service. It's all a bit shady anyway. So after that happened, and after asking their talent to appear on shows so that they could continue doing shows every week, they fired a bunch of the talent, despite being one of the biggest companies in the world in the industry, despite making millions of dollars every year, despite making a lot of the people they fired come to shows during a pandemic. Some of them had performed at shows just days before they got fired. They fucking fired him. And in a way, I've always been quite interested in this kind of stuff, and you know, to be real, Vince McMahon is a scumbag, so I'm not surprised. But still, it's quite fucked up. If you want to know more about this, or you're interested in hearing something a bit longer about this, because what I'm about to go into is not just specific to that particular issue. Grapple Spotlight, which is one of my favorite podcasts, did a whole episode on the situation. I'll link it in the description below. It's really good and you can listen to that, and they go a lot more in depth than I'm going to. So you can check that out if you want to know specifically about the fuckery that is what WWE did. But I'm talking more generally about companies throughout this crisis who have fucked over their staff. And we've seen a lot of that. At the beginning, there were companies who were forcing their staff to keep working even though it wasn't essential services. Places like WH Smith, Wetherspoons, I think Sports Direct did the same thing. Companies who, you know, were forcing staff to take pay cuts. That's something that's been seen a lot. There are companies that are taking advantage, UK specific now, of the job retention scheme, the furlough scheme. And they are furloughing staff, but still, you know, bothering their staff with work, which is not how the scheme is supposed to work. But it's happening anyway. There are staff that even with the job retention scheme and even with the wages coming from the government, not the company, who are being, you know, laid off, made redundant and things like that. I think this crisis has shown a lot of darkness from a lot of companies. Of course, there are companies who are doing a great job and who are looking after their staff, and that's wonderful. There are some wonderful companies who are doing what they can to take care of the people that they employ, and I think that that is wonderful. And once this is over, those brands and companies should get our support. But there are a lot more companies that are frankly exploiting people. They are doing horrific things, and my worry is that when this is over, people are just going to forget about it. Let's take Wetherspoons as an example, right? Wetherspoons were under a lot of fire at the start of the situation because Tim Martin, who owns Wetherspoons, was trying to force staff to continue working. And then when it became clear he wasn't going to be able to do that, he started, you know, appealing for pubs to be allowed to stay open, even though that would put people in danger. When he figured out that wasn't going to work, he then told the staff, well, I'm not paying you until the job retention scheme kicks in. Go and get another job. Even though this is a man who, he's so fucking rich. He's ludicrously rich. He is ludicrously rich. His company is ludicrously rich. And he has all that money because of the hard work of his staff, right? If his staff were not working hard, he wouldn't have that money. That's just the reality of things. And then on top of that, he was saying he wasn't going to pay suppliers and so on and so forth. Now, a lot of people are now saying, well, we're going to boycott Wetherspoons. You know, when this is over, we're never going back to a Wetherspoons again. Wetherspoons, terrible, never going there again. However, this is not the first time that it has become obvious that staff at Wetherspoons have been mistreated. Over the last few years, there have been stories of staff in Wetherspoons not being paid correctly, staff who are overworked, staff who do not have really proper rights at all. There was staff who, you know, who weren't allowed to take toilet breaks during shifts, staff who were being verbally abused at work. You know, Wetherspoons treating their staff like shit is not a new story. And yet everybody conveniently forgot, because drinks at Wetherspoons are cheap and the food is cheap. And so people forgot so that they could continue going there. And that's my concern. People are going to forget after this again. They're going to say, oh, well, Wetherspoons is back open and the drinks are cheap. And, oh, they've probably got some special offers on. And people are going to forget that solidarity they had with their staff. The same with stuff like Sports Direct. Again, Sports Direct treating their staff like shit is not a new story. There's been documentaries about it. There's been articles about it. Staff have bravely come forward and talked about their experiences and the mistreatment they've had working there for years now. And people would always say, oh, we're going to boycott them. But then they'd go back. And so again, I'm thinking, well, you're saying you're going to boycott them now. And it's easy to boycott them now because they're not open and you don't really have a choice in the matter. But when they are open, are you going to stick to that? And so I was thinking about this with the WWE story, because there was a lot of people saying, oh, well, I'm going to cancel my network subscription. I'm not giving them any more of my money. Vince McMahon can go fuck himself. He'd probably enjoy that. He just strikes me as a very, very sick man. I don't know. I've never really got a good vibe from him. But anyway, I'm getting away from the point. But people said they were boycotting over things like WWE's partnership with the Saudi Arabian regime. If you don't know what that's about, basically, the WWE takes money from the Saudi regime to put on shows in Saudi Arabia. Now, touring in Saudi Arabia, not really a problem. That's fine, right? But these shows that they were putting on had video packages that contained blatant propaganda and just very obvious whitewashing of things like human rights abuses and things like that. You know, the commentary on all the matches contained random, out of context propaganda buzzwords and bullet points. It was very obvious that the shows were not just so that people in Saudi Arabia could have that live experience, but it was also to sell Saudi Arabia as this fun, amazing, totally ethical and non-human rights violating tourist destination. And so obviously there were people uncomfortable about that, but a lot of the people who said they were boycotting, they still went back, you know. So it's like, well, are you though? Are you going to stick to it? I mean, I did. But to be fair, that was because I lost interest, because it sort of all occurred around the time when things were getting a bit crazy and generic. So I thought, well, you know, I'm not really losing much. So for me, it was easy to boycott. I could just walk away and be like, okay, well, that saves me $9.99 a month. But, you know, a lot of the people that said they were going to then didn't. And the same happened with Weatherspoons and Sports Direct. And, you know, and I'm not saying boycotting is easy, because it's hard. You have to find completely new ways to get things in your life sometimes. And that's a challenge for sure. But the reality is these exploitative, my God. Anyway, these exploitative practices will continue to happen as long as the businesses are making a profit. So, for example, WWE, right? If they go and they take cash from the Saudi regime to whitewash human rights abuses, but you still give them money and you reward them with your viewing figures and all that, they're just going to keep doing what they're doing. If they fire a bunch of staff during a global crisis, knowing full well that those staff will not be able to find other work because no other company is forcing staff to work and hiring people, but you keep giving them your business and you keep doing business with them, they don't learn anything from that. If Weatherspoons treats their staff like shit year after year after year, but you keep going in there because, oh, but it's cheap and, oh, the chocolate cake is nice and all this, they never learn. So, do you know what? I hope I'm wrong. And I hope that after this, the world as a whole, society as a whole, will stick to it and we'll say, well, you know what? We are not going to give money and profit and business to companies that treat people badly. If you treat people badly, we will show you what that means for us. And that means us taking our business somewhere else. I hope that happens, but I have my doubts because we've been in this situation before and it didn't happen. And also with this situation, there's so many companies being bastards. So I don't know if people are going to have the energy to stick to it. We'll have to see. But I'm hopeful, but my hopes aren't too high. But my main hope is that once this is over, we will realize, number one, brands are not our friends. They may act like that because it's a good strategy to sell things to us, but it's not true. Number two, it matters to stand up for other people. Even if it doesn't directly affect you, you know, like for me, right? If I go into Wetherspoons, which I haven't done in years because I don't, do you know what? I feel like for me, that's cheating because I don't even really go out all that often. But still, let's just say that I went into Wetherspoons, right? And I buy a drink or some food or whatever. Now, if a staff member that serves me that drink is being bullied by somebody else at work or is being screwed out of their fair amount of wages or hasn't been able to take a break in several hours, that doesn't directly affect me. But that doesn't mean that I don't potentially have a part to play in helping them. And I can help them by doing several things, actually. I can not go in and give money to that company and keep the profits going into that company so that they feel like their practices are okay. I can stand up for these people when they come forward and they talk about the way that they've been treated. I can support them and I can say, yeah, I'm here for you. I mean, additionally, there's other stuff like voting, but obviously we're not going to have the option to do that for a while, unfortunately. And you know me, I love a good vote, but you know, when it comes to that as well, you know, realistically, here in the UK, for quite a while now, we've had a government that basically openly invites businesses to exploit workers. Maybe we should look at that at the next election. I don't know, just a thought. But you know, there are ways of supporting people who are being mistreated. And yes, it may not directly affect your life that they are being mistreated, but it affects our society as a whole. And I just hope that once this is over, this energy that a lot of people have, because right now people are saying, we're going to boycott, I'm going to sign this petition, I'm going to tweet about this issue. I just hope we can keep that up going forward. And I hope we can make it bigger and better, you know, because, well, everything's been a bit shit here for a while. So don't you think we're deserving of, expanded employment rights, better wages, a better standard of living? What an idea, what a concept. Instead of aiming for the summer or for Christmas, why don't we aim for that? So, I'm not going to lie, I'm recording this Saturday morning. I'm not actually sure which part of the show I'm going to put this in. I suppose it could be a luxury hot take, but maybe I'll write something about a lesbian and just put it after that. We don't know. Anyway, my point is, it's Lesbian Visibility Week. Congratulations, lesbians. Love you. But, you know, it's a nice thing. From what I can tell, it's something that's been organised by Diva Magazine, which is a publication for LGBT plus women, including lesbians, obviously. And I think it is a good idea to have a Lesbian Visibility Week. The LGBT plus community is very big. There are a lot of people in it. And so sometimes it's hard to get to know each part of the community.
and to find out their stories and their history. For me, as an LGBT plus person, the history of our community is very important. That's something I've always been very interested in. So I'm all for like zeroing in on individual parts of our community, finding out more about, you know, the key pioneers of their section of the community, their struggles, their achievements. I love that. I am that, you know, super gay history nerd. So I think Lesbian Visibility Week is a good thing, and I'm totally for it. However, everything I have found about it, right, online, says that it is a week to celebrate lesbian and bisexual women. Now, as a bisexual woman, I have no problem being celebrated. I love that for me. I love to be celebrated. You know, that's totally up my street. But I feel like this is maybe one week of the year that I can accept the attention and stuff being on someone else, because the reality is lesbian and bisexual women are not the same. We will have different experiences. We'll see things differently. And I think it's a bit unfair on both sides, really, for bisexual women to be just kind of thrown in to Lesbian Visibility Week, because we're not lesbians, so that's a bit unfair on them. They should have the space and the time to celebrate themselves and their community and their experiences and their history, and their pioneers. They should have that time, and that shouldn't be taken from them. And additionally, even though it does seem to be well-meaning, it doesn't seem like anyone's done it to purposefully fuck with bisexuals. It does feel like another example of bisexual people being invalidated, being told, you know, yet again, that, you know, we are one thing when we're sitting here saying actually we're not. It is a long-standing thing to just kind of, you know, I guess disregard how bisexual people feel, saying, you know, it's something you see a lot with bisexual men. It'll just be, oh no, you're just gay, you're just too scared to come out. Or, you know, bisexual women, oh, you're just lesbians, you're just too scared to come out. Or, you know, and I feel like including bisexual women in Lesbian Visibility Week, even though it does seem to be well-meaning, it doesn't to me look like they've done it to invalidate anybody or to fuck with anyone. It does seem to be an attempt to highlight and celebrate bisexual women as well. And that's nice, but, you know, give us our own week. Don't take away time from lesbians, and don't invalidate us by pretending that we're exactly the same, because we're not. That would be my thoughts on it personally. You know, we have different experiences, and we'll have different experiences for the whole of our lives, because we are different. We have some things in common for sure, but that doesn't make us the same entirely. And I think it's healthy for both of us, lesbians and bisexuals, to have the space to acknowledge that and to talk about that and to talk about the differences. We can talk about the similarities too, but, you know, they deserve their recognition. They deserve their time to talk about themselves and have their moment. And so do we.
And they have the moment to talk about how they're different and what makes them different, and that's okay. And so for me, as well-meaning as this does seem to be to include bisexual women in this, to me it seems a bit misguided. Because, I mean, you know, we're not really the same. although it is nice to see a lesbian visibility week. I think that's a good thing. I know there are some people who will say stuff like, why do you need visibility weeks for lesbians? Why do you need more things to celebrate LGBT people? Don't you people have Pride Month and LGBT History Month and so on and so forth? Well, you know what? There are still people across the world who are persecuted for their LGBT identity. There are people who struggle within themselves because they feel like they can't be who they really are. You know, and these are not just things that happen in faraway places that you can't be bothered to Google. They're happening all over the world. And things like Lesbian Visibility Week, things like Pride Parades and LGBT History Month, they send a message to LGBT people that who they are is okay and that they can find safety and happiness in themselves. And I think that's necessary, and I think that's a good thing. So yes, we already have Pride Month and LGBT History Month, although I would say I feel like, you know, Pride Month is a bit of a wash this year because, well, we're not going to be able to do anything during it because we're all going to be locked in because of coronavirus. But I think everyone's doing it online. I don't know. God, Pride, you're like on a Zoom call. My God. But the point is, yes, we have those things, but that is after centuries of oppression. So, do you know what? There was a part of me for a second that was like, oh, would you question why there's a Black History Month? And then I remembered, they do every year. My God. You see, that's the funny thing, right? I observe all of these things because, you know, being, you know, LGBT, being biracial as well, I'm up to date on all this. That's something we could do with. I don't know if there is one. I have looked, but I've never found anything. Some kind of, you know, day for biracials. That'd be nice. I just want to be celebrated, really. I feel like it's time. But anyway, we could have like a little biracial person week and then follow that up with bisexual person week. And then, I don't know, maybe something for women after that. And then, I don't know, podcast host visibility week. I don't know. Just a whole month. Me. I'd love that. I love that for me. Anyway, happy Lesbian Visibility Week to all the lesbians out there. I hope that you have a wonderful time and people buy you lots of presents and give you things that are nice, like, you know, nice drinks and chocolates. And I hope you have a wonderful week being visible. Tell your stories. Record your history. This is really important, right? Sorry, I'm lecturing you and you're going to be like, oh, this uppity bisexual has something to say. But seriously, your community, right, is only kept alive by what you do with it. If you record your history for future generations to look back on, especially now during such an interesting time period, record your history, write a diary, keep a blog, do a podcast, fuck it, you know, do some YouTube videos. You might think that you, just you, person at home, doesn't matter, isn't important, but you are a part of something special. And one day there are going to be people who look back and they want to know what was happening for you. So record that history. Make that what you do with Lesbian Visibility Week, if you feel like it, you know, just record that history. Make sure future generations of the LGBT community know how important each part of the community was and what they did mattered, because you do matter, obviously. But yes, happy Lesbian Visibility Week. I hope you enjoy being visible. And I would say let's get together, you know, in June, but I think we all know that's probably going to still be illegal at that point. Breadcrumbs were seated behind us in the car as my eyes followed you, following the sat nav and avoiding my eyelashes that were loudly shouting, "Look at me so that I know that you love me." We scaled the sky, breadcrumbs closing their eyes, afraid of heights, and I thought of how I'd miss the sight of you cleaning your car when I was gone, far from you, the mountains, the bread I bought but never intended to eat, the way you asked if I was frightened by the reckless way you drive, the way I found myself sitting on the lap of fear, but denying its presence because you were present. I miss you, like your car probably misses the nice man at the car wash who takes good care of her and smiles as he holds her in his arms, wiping away the stresses of the world. I don't know why I'm fixating on the bread. I watched you take a bite the next morning as I wrote poetry about the way you'd held me the night before. You astounded me. And even though you were by my side, my body burned for you, not just with desire, but a desperate, pleading, needy kind of ache. Look at me so that I know that you love me. You kissed me instead, and my lips told my mind that sometimes a man can look with more than one of his senses. I was having a sandwich the other day. This story gets a lot more exciting than I just led you to believe, by the way. So I was having a sandwich, right? And because I feel very fortunate because I was able to get some bread at the shops, because getting bread is still a bit of a journey, you know? When you go to the shops and it can be a bit crazy and you're like, am I going to get it? I don't know. And you get to the bread aisle and it kind of looks a bit like a bomb site. But you managed to get something and you feel very fortunate. So I got some bread and I made a sandwich and it was lovely. And then for some reason, I started thinking about, it was a little while ago, and I was at the shops with my boyfriend, and I kept meaning to get something for breakfast. Okay. And firstly, this was before, like, panic buying was just kind of starting, but it was I'm recording this, and I just found, like, a blonde hair in my hair. I know this is way off topic, I'm just amazed by this. If you've ever seen me, my hair is, like, very dark, like, black, and there's just blonde hair that's just hanging out, I guess. Either that or I'm going grey far before my time. Or it could be, sorry, I know I'm darting way, like, all the points everywhere. My grandma has, like, this white patch of hair at the front of her hair and it looks really cool. Maybe I'm getting that. Oh my god, hang on. Oh my god, there's another, what the fuck? It is definitely blonde, it doesn't look grey. What is this? Oh my god, maybe it's from, like, when I used to bleach my hair. That is insane and crazy. Anyway, where was I? Yes, I was at the shops with my boyfriend. I was trying to get something to have for breakfast. They didn't have any pancakes, which I wanted. They didn't have, like, any sandwiches, like, pre-made sandwiches that I wanted. I know I'm sounding so spoiled right now. I'm sounding like such a brat, and you're going to be like, oh. Oh, boo-hoo, you couldn't get what you wanted at the shops. But this is going somewhere. So I just bought, like, some bread, right? And I was like, maybe I'll have a little bit of that. Because we were going on a long drive. And I was like, well, I haven't had any breakfast, and I should probably eat something, because otherwise I'm going to be, like, a complete brat all day. And it turned out I didn't eat anything, and actually, I was not terrible, as I remember it personally. He may remember it differently, and that I was like a total bitch the whole day, but I do not accept that. Anyways, so, but the bread just kind of stayed in the bag, and I didn't eat it. And in the end, he had it, not me, the next day. And so I just kind of fixated on this bread. I was sitting there, current day, having this sandwich, thinking, oh my God, remember that bread that I bought, and I just didn't end up having it at all, and then he had it, and then obviously I'm thinking about that day, and I'm thinking about, you know, we had a lovely time that day. That was, we went up to that restaurant in the mountains, and it was very special, very beautiful. And I guess I was just kind of wishing that I was back there in that time, because obviously, you know, being, as Celine Dion once said, all by myself, as did Bridget Jones, I guess I'm kind of nostalgic for when I wasn't, and especially with somebody that I love. And so I don't think it was really about the bread. I think it was just, that was the connection that my mind made. It's like, oh, I'm eating bread now. Hey, remember that time you didn't eat bread, but then like a bunch of other cool stuff happened? Let's think about that.
Thank you for listening to Sincerely Jennifer with me, Jennifer Wan. If you want to find more of my work, you can on my website, jenniferwan.com, or you can find me on social media, on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Reddit, SoundCloud, and pretty much every social media website ever, with the username Miss J Squared. Thank you to my amazing top tier patron supporters, Amanda, Kylie, Melissa, Anna, Sam, Katie, Christina, Josie, Gabriella, David, Eleanor, Alicia, Emily, Andy, and Tyler. I'll see you next time.